From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
I've never seen war-torn eyes. Does that make sense? I've never seen anything quite like it.
I suppose anything farming would be my passion. Like, I wouldn't consider it work, not that I get paid or anything.
But who's the record for the oldest person to...
I don't know that. No, I don't know that. Yeah. I don't know that. I'm the oldest Mayo man, though.
Yeah, and the only Mayo man, and the first Mayo man.
Yeah.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, West Cork's TikTok farming sensation, dealing or not with the huge energy price rises, and why climbing Mount Everest won't help you deal with the void inside you. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that jumps into the void to deal with its inner Mount Everest. The newsings from this morning's Ryan Tuberty show started in a continental fashion.
Spent the weekend, would you believe, in Paris, France. I had the most beautiful couple of days as a guest of the Irish in France organisation, and Paul Lynch, who runs that show with great style, very kindly said, come on over and meet everyone, which I did. So I want to say hello to a few people that I met, because it is knockout, the amount of Irish people in Paris. And I was struck by how it's not just dubs. They're from all over the island, and so it was obviously Saturdays. Got over in time to get a coffee on the Rue Mouffetard and in and around that beautiful Latin Quarter, and then it was time to watch the match. So we went to the pub, to an Irish pub, as it turns out, to watch the Irish defeat England, which we always love, in McBride's pub. And so thank you to the company of, among others, Mike Prendergast and Paul Rick McGuire. And then it was to the event the next day, which was the Irish in France at the beautiful cultural centre there. And Nora Hickey is the woman who runs that place with great panache. And that was where I started meeting the Irish with all their stories. And you've got the people like Kevin Davern from Enterprise Ireland and Brendan MacDonald from the IDA and Olivia Scullion from Tourism Ireland. And friends like Alex Fernandez, who's essentially the museum woman, like the museum men, the monuments men, she's like the monuments woman. Fascinating people with great insight into life. She learned her English actually in Athlone's when she stayed here in Ireland. But Kevin, Brendan, Olivia, Alex, a great company, and they gave me great insight into what it's like to be Irish over there and the stories that continue to bind France and Ireland, of which there are so many. Got up early at both mornings and went down to Père Lachaise. Have you been to them? It's the most remarkable graveyard cemetery in the world, I think. And there you'll see Chopin and Edith Piaf and Jim Morrison. His grave is, people go and they pour whiskey into the ground and they put lit cigarettes into the earth of where he is. But the Oscar Wilde headstone is the one I went to, and it used to be covered in lipstick because people would kiss the grave. And now it's not. If you look it up, you'll see it. It's very interesting. Most of the headstones around there are fascinating. And then on a more profound sense, you've got the World War II monuments, which are so heavy, and the statuary around that, and the French relationship with World War II, of course, is fairly complicated, but they have marked it as they do in their own way. And that is a cemetery that you must visit if you go to Paris, because you spend hours and hours walking around there. And, you know, I was talking on when I had to say a few words at this event about how Oscar Wilde was an Irishman who found safe harbour in Paris, and Charles de Gaulle was a Frenchman who found, as President of France, safe harbour here in Ireland when he came to Sneem and Kerry and then on to Cashel House in Connemara, and stayed there and found the peace that he required. But the stories continued. I met Susan Muss from Cratlow and County Clare and their company Le Cacatier, which is a coffee, a chocolate making company. They're delicious. And she asked me to say hello to her mum Esther and her dad Michael. Happy, of course, to do that. Music came from, among others, a band called No Crows. You might have heard of it, but they were gross. I was standing there for about an hour, I'd say, just watching them. And these fiddles and mandolins and just amazing Irish music. So I want to say good morning to the fellas, and indeed to Anna Houston from the band, and Steve Wickham, who you'll know well, and Philippe Carbonell, Rory Cohen, Oleg Panomarev, and Eddie Lee. Just great, great people. Their new CD is called Waiting for the Tide. I loved it. It was just live music, and there we were in the heart of Paris listening to, it was a selection of global tunes, but once they went Irish, of course, you felt not only proud, but just it was great to be among people again, and live music and people dancing and celebrating Ireland.
'Tis the time to be celebrating Tolsard, of course. But speaking of La Belle France, there's an election campaign going on there, and Ryan noticed a not-so-subtle change in the appearance of the French president.
And poor old Macron. Funny, I was going through a little market, the fruit and veg market, on Sunday morning after the cemetery, and just like here, they were handing out leaflets with Macron's face going, you know, vote for me. Nothing changes. Politics, all politics are local. Is Macron, the question is, in a lot of papers today, trying to copy Zelensky? Because suddenly, he's very, as you know, Macron's, I'd say, quiet about the style, as are most French people, as I was reminded at the weekend, how effortlessly chic they are. I mean, it is remarkable, men and women. And then I think, effortlessly? I think it probably takes a lot of effort to look that chic. But nevertheless, they look amazing. And they reckon now in these photographs, suddenly Macron, who's always in his navy suit, and his tie is always, because I spot this, I wear a shirt, you know, suit a lot, and you know, you've got to get the knot right on the up at the button. You know, there's nothing worse than a, you know, a sloppy knot. You know, in sartorial terms, and Macron is a very well turned out man, as you'd expect. But there's now full photos of him, and it's a bit. He's now wearing a hoodie. It's a wartime hoodie. He's got stubble. The hair is a little bit ruffled because it's normally quite groomed. And they're saying now, I think he's trying to out Zelensky a little bit. Is that cynical? I wonder, or is that a fair shot? He's hardly ever been caught in anything other than a dark, slim-fitting suit and tie, it says in the papers this morning. But the seemingly candid shots, which don't look like that, display Macron at work sporting stubble, oversized hoodie with jeans. And the image was released by the president's official photographer. Okay. But they were generally well-received on social media, to give him his credit. And some have accused him of launching a marketing ploy to look more like Zelensky. But you have a look at them and you can decide yourself. He's getting on with his job and he'll probably be sail into his second term of the presidency there in France.
Will he though? Will he? We'll see. But wait, you say, what's the story with Dolly and the Hall of Fame?
Now, Dolly Parton, speaking of which, has decided that she doesn't want to be in contention for a rock and roll Hall of Fame nod, because as they say, a bone of contention for many rock music fans has been the very wide net that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame casts in nominating artists. And all the good things you can say about Dolly Parton, rock and roller is not one of them in the true sense. Okay, so here's Dolly Parton saying, do you know what, you're right. So she agreed and sent a letter to them to say, I'm out, I don't want to be considered for this thing because I'm not a rock and roller. Like, that's this woman, it's endless, her class and the good things she does. So she says, she uses it at this opportunity to remind herself that she's been wanting to do a rock album. So then she'll do the rock album, then she'll get the nomination, and then she'll get there she'll be delighted with herself.
Will she, though? Will she? Okay, I'll stop now. In fact, we'll all stop now and leave the newsings right there. Not much news in the newsings this morning, was there? Anyway, we're leaving them for another day. In August 2014, 46-year-old Karen McCabe died of a blood clot 9 days after a routine operation to remove varicose veins. Last week, her family, husband Michael and daughter Shauna and her two sons, settled an action against two hospitals and a hospital consultant. Shauna spoke this morning to Claire Byrne. When the tragedy happened, Shauna had just turned 13.
So I had only turned 13 and my two younger brothers were 7 and 9. So they were all very much very young.
Very young. Will you tell me a little bit about your mother, about Karen?
Yeah, so I suppose we were, you know, lucky enough that we had our kind of childhood with my mom, and, you know, she was in good health, like she wasn't sick. So overall, I guess my mom was really mad, is what people would describe her as. She definitely was full of life. You know, like my dad always says, there was just so much life in her. You know, she really just lived to have fun and to laugh. And she had so much love to give everyone. She was so caring, you know. Mm-hmm. She kind of dedicated her life to looking after us and my granny. She was so supportive of my dad and his company. And, you know, she just really, I suppose, lived to have fun and just look after people.
And your statement, which was read out in court, you said that your family and your lives changed forever.
Oh, completely. You know, like, my mom really was the foundation of our lives. You know, my dad always says that when she had three of us, like, her life was complete. It was all that she wanted and it was all she ever asked for. So my mom had a very successful career before she had us. But once we were born, she stopped working. And she kind of dedicated her life to looking after us and, you know, to staying home and bringing us up and, you know, to making sure that we got the best education that we could. And, you know, she supported my dad with his company, but I suppose she was the main caregiver at home. She was the foundation of everything.
There was a great love, as I understand from what I saw and what you said and what your dad said, the great love between them, between your dad and your mum.
Yeah, so my parents had been together for 32 years. They met when they were quite young, you know, and I suppose it just kind of took off from there. You know, they bought their first house together. You know, my mom supported my dad in everything that they did, you know, and they were a great team. My mom was home-minding us and supporting my dad with his business. Now, my dad definitely got off lightly beforehand. You know, he wouldn't have done much at home, but it was a great team that they had. You know, it was a great dynamic, and it worked for us. And overall, just our family was kind of the centre of everything for us.
Well, let's talk a bit about what happened. As I said there at the beginning, Shauna, this was a routine operation, wasn't it?
It was. So it was an operation to remove varicose veins, which I'm sure as many people know is a general thing that happens. It's more of a cosmetic surgery. It's not because of any illness or sickness. So it is a routine operation. So my mom had the operation on the 6th of August, 2014. And the operation went well. Everything went smoothly. The consultant was happy with us, and she was discharged the same day. And she came home, and she was in good spirits. You know, and she was fine, other than, you know, a few stitches on her leg and a bandage. She was her normal self. Everything went well.
But then a week later, she went back to the hospital, and it was the Bon Secours Hospital in Glasnevin in Dublin where she'd had the operation. She went back there, didn't she, because she was having some pain?
Yeah, so I suppose a few days afterwards, I'd say about 4 days, my mum started to get excruciating pain in her leg, kind of around her knee area and the back of her knee. My two younger brothers and I were at home with her. My dad had returned to work. And we were just in the house, and it was during the summer, and I suppose we really noticed that something was wrong, you know, something had deteriorated. Like, I remember standing in the kitchen with my mom, and she was bending over the countertop, holding on, screaming, and throwing up, and she just was not well, and she couldn't put any weight on her leg whatsoever. So she, on the 12th, actually, so that was the following Tuesday, she called up the Bon Secours for us. She explained to the nurse on the phone that something wasn't right. You know, she was in a lot of pain. She wasn't quite sure what had happened, what was going wrong, but she needed help. The nurse suggested that we went on a short walk just to try, you know, get blood moving, and that might help. So we actually walked around to a local shop. It's only about a kilometre away. And, you know, I was only 13 and the boys were only 7 and 9, but we actually got stuck in the car park in the shop because my mum couldn't move. She was in so much pain. And she stood in the car park screaming. And I remember kind of standing there and I was like, stop screaming. People are looking. This is so embarrassing. But she genuinely was in so much pain. You know, my mum would have been very tough. Like, she would never have showed her pain towards us or anything. You know, she kind of sheltered us from everything. So it was very unusual, you know, and I called my dad immediately to come home, and, you know, I was very distressed on the phone. I thought something's not right. So the next day, my dad decided that, you know, we had to go back into Boxers. So my granny had come out that day to, you know, help around the house and look after us. So I actually was left in the Bon Secours hospital that evening with my mum while my dad and brothers dropped my granny home. But this is definitely a day that, you know, I still haven't got nervous, and I hold a lot of guilt around this day. And you know, the Wednesday in the box series is very distressing for me. You know, I suppose I was the only person there with my mom. So this is kind of where the issue started, because basically the volunteers couldn't help my mom that day. This really was the beginning of it.
So, but just so to let people know, it was said in court that the consultant who had performed the operation, Professor Austin Leahy, he was on holiday at the time. He couldn't be contacted. Yes. And then we have this problem with the hospital protocols at the time, because they couldn't contact any other consultants at the time. Is that right, Shona?
It is. So the policy back then was that any doctor or nurse had to contact the primary consultant to readmit a patient. Dr. Austin Leahy was away, and you know, there was just this big, huge blur of no policy in place, really. It wasn't a plan that was actionable. So the doctor, on the ward that evening, he did want to admit her, but he didn't have the authority to do so.
So even though that junior doctor wanted to admit your mother for tests and further examination, the protocols in place at the time didn't allow a non-consultant doctor to do that?
No. There was nothing there supporting the junior doctor. He was at a kind of lost cause.
So like even the alternative, which you might automatically think of, you know, to text the doctor, the consultant, that wasn't there. The system didn't provide that option to the staff. So your mum wasn't admitted at that time, and was she sent home?
Yeah, so the doctor returned and he just said, you know, there's nothing that I can do. So you have to leave. So, you know, my mom is very distressed and in pain, and I, you know, kind of physically carried her body weight out of the hospital. You know, and it's a guilt that's kind of stayed with me, because, I mean, we've gotten countless expert medical reports since then, you know, trying to figure out where the mistakes lay and where they came from. You know, and the doctors have said that if my mom had been admitted to hospital that evening, she would still be here. You know, she would have survived.
It's just heartbreaking to hear you say that you're carrying all of this guilt, because I'm listening to you now as a young woman, but at the time you were 13, you were a child.
I know, but why did I take the responsibility of actually carrying my mom out? Like, my mom couldn't walk. And I suppose I was only 13. Like, I just wanted to get my mom to my dad, you know, and kind of say, I don't know what to do, like, help. Like, we don't know what to do. He said he can't help. You know, but if I had stayed there that night, you know, she would be here.
What's the impact on you now? Like, how does that guilt that you talk about manifest? I mean, you talked about nightmares. You still have those, do you?
Oh, every night. Do you know what? I suppose from the actual week itself, and from seeing my mom in so much pain, and from being in the hospital and having to carry her out and being very present with it, I've nightmares about that, you know, because I feel a huge amount of guilt around that, because I was responsible in one way. You know, I was there to help her and I didn't do that.
But I'm sure so many people have said to you, Shona, that it's not your fault, you know.
No, I know that. I know, but I think because no one has taken responsibility, that responsibility has to fall on someone. You know, like, I have nightmares that I'm in the bond secures up on the lift and I can see the doctor and the nurses that were on the ward that night. But we're stuck in the lift and no one will help us, because that's what it felt like.
Desperately sad. That's Shona McCabe on Today with Claire Byrne this morning, talking about the medical mistakes that led to her mother's death in 2014. On this afternoon's Live Line, Joe Duffy started with Bord Gáis Energy's shocking announcement that gas and electricity prices will be going up by a very large amount indeed.
Your average gas bill is going up. That's the biggest single jump in the history of gas bills, I think, in Ireland. The average gas bill will go up by 39% in less than a month's time. And the electricity bill, if you're with Bord Gáis Energy, will go up by 27%. So that's a shock. They're also terminating their winter price pledge immediately. And the company said it's working with MABS, the Money Advice Bridging Service, and establishing an earth support, an energy support fund. Bord Gáis Energy blamed the price rises on the persistence of high demand on gas worldwide, reduced supplies, low storage volumes, geopolitical issues, and late winter conditions. Michael Moriarty. Michael, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
The word now, Michael, electricity going up just under 30% next month and gas going up 40%.
But all I can see them doing is robbing the poor. They're putting it up just because they can do. We can't switch. We can't do nothing because we're in such a low income.
And what is your, just tell me your own circumstances, Michael.
Well, we have an oil-fired central heating. Okay. We put on for half an hour in the morning.
Okay.
That tripled in price this year. And the government turned around and said, we don't fix oil. Well, herself keeps all the oil receipts we get. Last year, we paid £35 for a fill of oil in tax. This year, when we got oil filled, it was £100 in tax. They might have some excuse and say, it's this Mickey Mouse word in their head, but it's still tax.
Because there's VAT and carbon tax. It's pity your line is not great. And your electricity bill, we presume it's going to be the same for the other suppliers of electricity, energy and ESB and what have you. But your electricity bill is going up by 30% next month.
But it's gone up through the roof already. They gave us that £200. But when they give £200, because we're on the old age pension, they give us 4 or 5 months down the line, not when it's gone up.
Okay, and the 200 euro is coming in the next, well, it'll be in the April bill, I think. Well, it depends on the logistics of it.
But then if you're saying it's gone up 40 to 30%, should that, you might as well give you a cup of water. Do you know, it's rubbish.
And how will you manage when, if gas goes up 40%, which it is, no if anymore, no if, and electricity goes up 30% in the next few weeks, how will you manage? What will you do?
What we do now is we light the fire on the front roof and we sit in there and we just... And what we did was we put an extra duvet on the bed and we put a hot water in the bed at night, a hot water bottle. We still have the old hot water bottle.
Okay.
And it's all right, Michal Martin and the rest of them are saying, here's a fiver, a ready fiver in 3 years.
Okay, well, it's a savage blow to so many people. It really is, it really is. And have you got, in your home, for example, Michael, obviously, have you a landline?
No, we don't, because that's another
charge, okay.
But
have you broadband or internet?
No, we don't have that, because we don't use it. Okay. I'm 67, herself is 69. And if you have to get that in there, I suppose when the grandchildren get older, they'll come and put it in for themselves to do whatever they're doing with that.
Yeah, yeah.
But we can't afford that.
Okay, hot water bottles and double duvets, my God. We never thought we'd be going back to that. And what about groceries and how are you managing there? Have you noticed the increase there, Michael?
Herself goes round. We go into town into Tralee once every 2 weeks.
Okay.
And Dunn's give us the tenner off on the petrol.
The 50,
and she does all the shops, Lidl's, Aldi's, all them shops. And she does that shopping. But everything's gone up 10, 15, everything's gone 10, 15% on each.
Well, let me ask you, you're in Kerry. Do you buy butter? Do you buy Kerrygold?
No, we don't. We buy the cheapest butter going because I eat margarine and you know that blue thing, I forget what it is.
So the cheapest butter going is margarine. That's what you're saying.
No. We buy ordinary butter. Herself likes butter.
Okay,
that's the only thing she eats. And I eat the floor of margarine. But that's gone up £2 a container in a year. €2. It's gone up €2 a container.
Yeah, and every other thing, every else. But it's a sad, well, it's a sad day when people in Ireland can't afford butter, where people in Ireland have to put double duvets on. I don't know, people say, well, the climate change, people probably say, well, that's a good idea anyway. Use a less...
But who represents us? We have two parties in there, and they went in with them fools of Greens, and they closed... God, open up the three turf power stations. We have men there able to work. We can produce our own electricity. And you have that idiot of a fellow on the Green Party. Saying,
okay, one person is... But Michael, don't be worrying. Michael, but one, the statement Borghar said at the end, that they blame the price rises, the persistent of high demand of gas worldwide, reduced supplies, low storage volumes. Now, one of the problems in Ireland, Lucinda Creighton actually highlighted it in the Sunday Business Post on Sunday, there was an interest in building a liquid petroleum gas storage plant down near you, actually, down near Ballylongford.
Yeah, I see it, yeah.
But the Greens have said no, there's a veto on that, so that's gone. We've no storage for gas.
But they don't care about us. They care about their policies.
And then the geopolitical issues are obviously Ukraine. We've no control over that.
I understand that. I understand them poor people out there. But that thing down there on Limerick should have been done 10 years ago. The 10 years fighting to get that in there.
Yeah, but my understanding is the Greens managed to get a veto on it, and they said it will not be built because there's a possibility some of the gas that would be brought from the States to be stored there could have been produced by fracking. And then, well, you know the argument about that.
I disagree with fracking because they don't know what you're doing to the earth underneath. I'm not one of these people. I don't support the Greens. But I've lived long enough now that you shouldn't be Mickey Mouse and jelly igniting under the earth if you don't know what the crack is. Do you know? But they have a policy that they're going to put forward, and they don't care about us. They don't give a monkey's about the poor people. We got a fiver in 3 years, right?
This is
in our pension. Yeah. A fiver. And then every time the electricity bill, it's gone out the window.
Joe Duffy discussing the huge rises in energy bills announced by Bord Gáis Energy today with caller Michael Moriarty on this afternoon's Live Line. Katie Shanahan is a farmer, amongst many other things, who also shares farming videos on TikTok. But when she spoke to Ryan Tuberty this morning, our host wanted the gory details of how Katie's phone got damaged while she was lambing the yows.
Bring me back to that moment. You were lambing the yow. So what time of the day was it? Who was with you? Paint the picture for me.
I was by myself. I was actually lambing one of my own pets. Her name is Polly. So everything was going well. My phone was in my pocket. And just as I was turning, it clipped out. And of course, it landed into the one bucket that was inside in the whole house.
I'm always full of the bucket full of?
Water.
With a view to. And how's Polly?
Oh, she's great. She's lovely. Two little lambs. And she's very happy.
So good day at the office in terms of the animal kingdom. Bad day for the technological world.
Yeah, we'll get over that though.
Whose phone are you on now?
I'm on my mother's phone, Sheila.
Will you tell Sheila I said thanks?
Oh, she was on the ball here when I ran in to get her phone.
No bother on her. She was straight out of the phone and said, take this one. Yours landed in a bucket when you were lambing a yo earlier on in the week. So that's fair enough. Katie, talk to me about, you mentioned that you do a whole different types of jobs, but let's talk about the TikTok thing for the moment, because I was watching your TikToks, and obviously we get a great look at life on the farm. You've got a great sense of humour. What for people who don't know what you do, tell us what you do on TikTok.
So basically, I started TikTok. We were hit with COVID last January, so our whole house was in lockdown. So I started making just normal day-to-day videos, no fancy editing, no fancy script, just real life day-to-day living on a farm. And it absolutely took off on TikTok. People loved it. People loved the whole female aspect of it as well. And so I didn't realize how many views I was getting. I was so naive to the whole thing, but I've really taken to it, and I really love and I enjoy it now. I do.
Yeah, the videos has nearly pretty much 4 million views of you casually jumping over an electric fence.
I know.
Why do 4 million people, or at least why do 4 million views accumulate for such a thing? What is the appeal? Have you tried to break that down and understand it?
Sometimes I just don't understand it. Like, you could spend, you know, maybe 20 minutes making this really fancy, high edited, really knowledgeable on agri. I could do a 2 minute video on how I lamb a yo, and, you know, or really knowledgeable agricultural videos. And it's always these silly videos of doing something absolutely making a fool of myself. I suppose people just find entertaining. They'll pass it on to their friends. They'll have a laugh. And it's always these videos that get the views, so I always laugh at that.
You've also, I noticed it a few times, you've done this thing where it's almost like a split screen, where it's you on the farm looking like you're you on the farm.
Oh, my transformations.
Transformation. Tell us about the transformations of Katie Shanahan.
Well, I'm a girly girl. I will say I love getting done up. I love makeup. I always have loved it, and I think that came from Irish dancing. But I will start off the video in my work clothes, day-to-day living. I look an absolute mess, hair on top of my head. And then I'll transform in the video to my ready-to-go-out and hit the town outfit.
So it's a pretty, pretty big before and after setup, isn't that it?
Oh, massive, yeah. I'm your modern-day agricultural catfish, I suppose.
Okay. You mentioned that the farm isn't the only show in town for you, so tell me a little bit about what else you're up to.
Yeah, so, like, realistically, it was only last year I really fell back in love with farming, and that was due to the lockdown and being at home a lot, because I also teach dancing, and I'm with the Kylie Walsh Academy in Cork, so yeah. Big shout-out to them.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And so I teach Irish dancing, and, of course, with lockdown, children lost all their activities, which was such a shame. Mm. I couldn't teach dancing. I couldn't do anything during the week, so I was at home more often, and that enabled me to start all this TikTok and Instagram and all this agri and social media stuff.
You mentioned that you fell back in love with agriculture, the farming world. Had you fallen out of love with it?
Not really, but I suppose when I was in school, yes, I loved it. I used to go out with my brothers and my dad and my mom, and we're very much a family-run farm here. But then I went off to college and I did social science down in Waterford. Right. So shout out to all my girls there. I know they're listening. And yeah, I came back then, and I am a social care worker as well. So it wasn't until I kind of took a step back due to COVID, and I realised I love being outdoors. I love lambing. I love everything got to do with it. So I'm glad, in one sense, what COVID brought me.
Can you give us a sense of the farm you have there? What area of the farming world are you working on?
So we have sheep, we have pedigree sheep, and we just have your normal commercial sheep, and we also have commercial cattle as well, but we're very much into the horses as well, so we do have a bit of everything.
You're one year into a Green Cert program?
Yeah, so I started the Green Cert in September down in Clonakilty Agricultural College.
Yeah.
So started there in September. It's going great. I love it. I'm doing the distance learning course, which is mainly online. We do one day a week down in Clonakilty, just because obviously a lot of people that are doing that type of course are in full-time employment or they have families. So we're kind of an older group, but I love it. Yeah, so 1 year down and one to go.
And what about the coaction setup?
Yeah, so I know, it's like a list of jobs
It is. It's only because I've never heard, you've got some work ethic, but tell me about that group.
Yeah, so I'm in coaction now with, I suppose, going on 3 years. So I've always loved working with people, helping people. So I've been in the disability sector really since I left college, and I absolutely love it. And, you know, the people I mind, they love the animals. I'll bring them home sometimes to look and see the baby lambs, and they absolutely love it. So it's really nice.
So I've kind of lost count of how many jobs you have. What is your passion then?
I suppose anything farming would be my passion. Like, I wouldn't consider it work. Not that I get paid or anything, but I wouldn't consider it a job. It's something I love doing. But definitely the whole work ethic comes from my mom, Sheila. She has numerous jobs herself, so I definitely get that from her.
Irish dancing, are you teaching Irish dancing at the moment?
I am, yeah. We're back now, thank God, with restrictions gone. So
what day of the week? What days of the week are you doing that?
Monday to Thursday after school.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday?
Yeah.
And then the coaction is?
Every second weekend.
And Clonakilty is?
One day a month.
Okay.
Yeah, and then during the week, then I'm at home with Dad.
Okay.
Because my two brothers are actually, they have jobs on farms, but elsewhere.
Oh, right. Oh my goodness. Okay.
It's
full on. It's full on in your world. And then this week, what's happening this week, Katie? You're busy too.
What's happening this week on the farm?
No, well, in your life.
Oh, in my life. Well, actually, we have a wedding this week, so it is kind of very hard juggling farm life with nail appointments, hair appointments, tan appointments. So I'm a bridesmaid this weekend for my uncle's wedding, and so that's we're all looking forward to that.
So who's your uncle?
He's Donald Williamson from Letts. He's marrying Louise O'Sullivan, so we're definitely looking, and their child Eddie would actually feature on a lot of my TikToks. Everyone loves Eddie. He's a little 2-year-old toddler, and he absolutely loves farming. He's the hardiest little man I'd say in Ireland.
Wow. The busy, busy life of Katie Shanahan, farmer, TikToker, Irish dancing teacher, carer, bridesmaid, on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. I may need to lie down. How much tech is too much tech when it comes to your children? That's the question that Claire Byrne put to Irish Times technology correspondent Kira O'Brien this morning.
Tech, apps, games on all sorts of devices, it is a constant battle. And I say this from experience, and I'm sure you're in the same boat, right?
I am indeed. I have two children who probably know their way around an iPad better than most adults. And there is a kind of a balancing act to be done here, because I think we're kind of past the point now where you can kind of say to kids, no, absolutely no screen time whatsoever. It's not realistic anymore. I don't think it was ever realistic to start with. I mean, I was looking at the guidelines for screen time from the WHO, and they recommend between birth and 2 years of age, they recommend absolutely zero sedentary screen time. So that means, you know, you don't stick your kids in front of a telly or in front of an iPad and just kind of mindlessly watch stuff, which we all know, I'm sorry, with the best will in the world, there is no parent, I think, out there that can honestly say they haven't stuck their child in front of cartoons for 5 minutes at a time just to get something done. You would go absolutely mad if you couldn't. Mm-hmm. That's the reality of it now. But I think that the key thing there is sedentary screen time, because there's a difference between this and active screen time. Now, active screen time would be like your educational apps, because, I mean, I'll hold my hands up and say, you know, when I went back to work after my first child, the only way I could get things done in the morning was if she had an iPad that had an educational app on it. I used educational apps because it made me feel less guilty about sticking her in front of an iPad. But, you know, the upshot of that is now she's 7 years of age. She can read. People kind of think that if you give your child an iPad, that worst case scenario, they're going to turn into a complete zombie with it. She's not. And it actually helped her in terms of, you know, knowing her letters at an early age.
Can I just glean from your brain, your experience, what apps did you use and do you use for your children, the ones that you would recommend?
So the ones that I would recommend is, there's one called Sago Mini School, which is an educational app. So it teaches kids about nature, about growing plants, about bugs. It brings in stuff like spatial awareness, so you have to fill blocks into things, but it's fun. So, I mean, kids don't realise that they're actually learning these skills while they're doing it, which for an awful lot of children is fairly key. There's another one for that Sago Mini World, which is along the same lines, you know, where they can create different things. And then you can keep an eye on what they're doing, because there's a parent app linked to that. Now, there is an Irish company. This is a new one that was set up in the last couple of years called Holotoys. I did a review of their products there in the health and family section a couple of weeks ago. And my 4-year-old absolutely loves them, because what it is it uses augmented reality with physical products. So you have a book, or you have stickers, or there's wall decals. And there's an app that goes with it, and you point the app at the picture or at the book, and it brings it to life. My 4-year-old regularly rocks up with the book and plops in front of me and asks me to turn the app on so he can bring the book to life. And, you know, which is a huge win from my perspective, because the book section of the app will read the book to them while they can kind of interact with the little images on it. So you get like there's one on sea life, so you can interact with dolphins and make the dolphins jump and, you know, move around. And he absolutely loves it. And again, it's not sedentary. It's active. Like, he's actively engaging. He's learning about nature. He's learning about pets. He's learning about sea life while he's doing this.
Okay, so that's Holo Toys. H-O-L-O and then Toys, but spelt T-O-Y. Not with an S, is it?
It's a Z.
Yes. Okay.
And the other thing with that is that they're all under about €25. Even the most expensive product, which is the wall decals, everything is under €25. So this is not going to break the bank.
Okay. Now, we're limited for time because we're coming up to news. But I also want to ask you about the various apps that you can put on, or systems you can put on your devices to protect your children. What's the best one? Do they work?
They do work, because look, at the end of the day, you've got to protect your children. The internet is great. There's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of benefits to it. There's a lot of stuff out there. There's also a lot of bad stuff. And you need to know what your children are doing until they're of an age where they can make that decision for themselves. And for every child, that's going to be different. So what I first say is, you know, talk to your child first, because education can't replace an app. So my 7-year-old knows if she wants to go on YouTube, she has to come and ask me, and there has to be somebody sitting beside her, because you don't know what they're going to what kind of rabbit hole they're going to go down. If you're at the point where you feel like monitored internet access is your best bet, there are built in restrictions and monitoring on both iOS and Android devices that you can very easily enable. They are free. They're great. They give you a kind of a bird's eye view of what your child is doing. If you want something a bit more, something like Kaspersky's Safe Kids or Norton, they all have parental controls in it. And Vodafone has a secure net kind of internet monitoring and filtering product for its customers that you can enable on their devices, okay, on their internet devices.
When I was your age, technology was called books. That's Irish Times technology correspondent Ciara O'Brien talking to Claire Byrne this morning about tech and your children. Mayo man Kieran Lally visited the base camp at Mount Everest just before he got married in 1989, and it made him want to climb the mountain at some stage in his life. He described seeing the base camp for the first time on this afternoon's Ray Darcy show.
Base camp at that time, it was so colourful. It was, but we'd reached our destination, but at the same token, I wasn't ready to turn back. I was looking at these guys. These guys had just, they were at the beginning.
Yeah.
And they were about to set off, and I saw a number of them going off into the glaciers, into this broken up glacier, and just disappeared into the glacier. And I said, my God, I think I wouldn't mind being a bit like them guys.
Right.
Yeah.
And did you feel that you weren't?
Well, I wondered why I had limited my expectation to base camp. Like, when we set off, this base camp was the goal. This was the Mecca. It was, yeah, it was all I wanted to achieve. And then when I got there, there was another group of people at the beginning of, yeah, their quest, and I says, God, well, why had I limited myself? Well,
the itch that started off at base camp in 1989 didn't leave Kieran as the milestones rolled by.
So then basically we got our, went back in Dublin, we got our mortgage, and we got involved in buying and renovating a house. And a while later, our son Owen came along. And a while after that, I got a bit restless. And Geraldine gave me her blessing to go and climb Kilimanjaro. And that sort of took the, how will I call it, the restlessness out of me for a year or two. And then I took my eyes, went to Georgia in Russia, on a mountain called Elbrus. It's about the same height, around 6,000 metres, maybe a bit less, but it had got snow and ice. And with that experience behind me, I came back and I was okay again for another year or two. But at this stage, I wanted to increase height.
Right.
So my eyes went towards Argentina, and the mountain is called Aconcagua, and that's 7,000 metres.
Okay.
And the beauty of 7,000 metres is, on the higher mountains, that's where you start using oxygen. So basically, it was the highest mountain outside of the Himalayas. So the next obvious step was the Himalayas.
All right. But was that always your goal, though? Were you, you know, in your quiet moments, were you dreaming of the top of Mount Everest?
Well, you're gradually building confidence. All of a sudden you can say, hey, I'm good for this. Yes. I've got this bit of experience. I've got that bit of experience.
What age were you at that stage?
What?
What age were you?
Oh, God, I would have been about 48 or maybe 50.
Right.
Yeah, 48, 49.
Okay.
I was cutting it tight.
Yeah. Who was the record for the oldest person to...
I don't know that. No, I don't know that. Yeah. I don't know that. I'm the oldest male man, though.
Yeah, and the only male man. And the first male man.
Yeah.
So you were improving your CV and you were getting more and more experience with rocks and ice and oxygen, all building towards... a big one.
Yeah, and the other part of it is it's sometimes it can be a lonely quest. You can be there on the mountain for quite a while, and you might be asking yourself, what am I at? Like, basically, there are more comfortable places to be. But at the same token, you also learn, the higher the mountain, the longer the period of time to climb it. So you're learning how to deal with this isolation. And that's key, because people just up and leave. They just say, if you go on too big of an expedition too quickly, too soon, too early, there's a danger that you'll just pack up tent and go.
Yeah.
You just might say, to hell with this. This is not for me.
Right. I'm fascinated by people who climb Mount Everest. And the question I ask every time, and I still haven't got
an answer, and it's unlikely you'll get one this time, but anyway.
Well, you know what it is. It's a big, huge, three-letter word.
Oh, the big why.
Yeah, why? Why? He's taking off his jacket. He's getting serious now. He's taking off
I'm
his
under
jacket.
Pressure here. Yeah. Why? I don't know that I've ever really uncovered the answer to that. But basically, it's to prove something to yourself, which you don't end up doing in the end, at the end of it all. But afterwards, after climbing it, you can... I try to answer some of these questions in the book.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of reflection to be done afterwards, because in the doing of it, you're too caught up in the doing of it to think very clearly.
Yeah, so on the
outside of what you're doing, actually doing.
Of course, because it that takes up all your energy and your everything, your emotions, yeah. Everything. So on reflection then, I suppose, do you think before you do it that it's going to be one of those huge life-changing achievements, that you will be a different person? Of course, we're a different person after anything, because that's the way we're constantly changing. But did you think this was going to do something for you? Was there something you felt you had to fix, some void you had to fill?
I'd say there was a void for sure, and I think you're burning up the energy. And a lot of the time, I think a lot of these things are distractions as opposed to actually looking for some magic wand. You know? But like, I mean,
distractions from what, Kieran?
Distractions from dealing with the void.
So you climb Everest as a way to deal with the void inside you, but the whole climbing Everest hoo-ha only distracts you from dealing with the void inside you. 'Tis passing strange. That's the only Mayo man, so far, to have climbed Mount Everest, Kieran Lally, talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon. Finally on today's Playback Daily, Patricia Murray, work psychologist with the Health and Safety Authority, joined Claire Byrne this morning to talk about navigating the post-COVID workplace. Claire started by asking Patricia what she's been hearing since restrictions were largely lifted 2 weeks ago.
We in the HSA are getting queries from both employers, I'd say equally with employees. So a lot of employers are saying, we're getting queries from our employees and we just don't know how to answer them. So can you give us a steer? And then employees are, the query I'm getting from employees most often is, am I allowed to? Am I allowed to, literally? And I'm thinking, you never would have asked, am I allowed to before now? So what's that coming from? So people are kind of confused about what they're allowed to even ask. So am I allowed to ask if I can wear my mask because nobody else is wearing theirs? Am I allowed to ask anybody else if they wouldn't mind wearing a mask? So as a psychologist, I suppose the issue is not the protocols from my perspective. The issue is, why are you feeling so uncertain that it's bothering you, this ambiguity?
And so why is that happening? Why are people in that space where they're asking those questions?
I suppose from a psychological point of view, again, all we can do at the moment in psychology is look at research from similar things, because we haven't had another pandemic, and look at why it is. And often if people have been given a lot of instruction over a period of time, so their self-regulatory processes have been put to the side and they've been very influenced by the rules, they're then nervous about going back and having no rules, because rules are a bit of a comfort blanket. Even if you don't like the rules, they're a comfort blanket because they're what everybody's doing.
Well, at least it's clear cut when you have, exactly, when someone's telling you what,
exactly,
to do.
Exactly. So a little bit of me discussing them with people is, you know, first of all, there are protocols there insofar as, you know, it's over in terms of the mask wearing or whatever those things are. But every employee is different. Every workplace is different. Every situation is different. So I'd be saying to those people, it is a bit ambiguous now, mm-hmm, and you really need to either seek clarity from your employer or from your colleagues, or do whatever suits you. If you want to wear your mask, I'm sure you can wear it.
So there's a bit of figuring out to be done between the employer and the employee. So how do you recommend they come together and work it out?
Well, our approach in all health and safety is always consultation. It really is. And at the moment, we're very much in the kind of trial and error, I suppose, hopefully less error, more trial. It's a period of getting used to being back. And like anything, that one is, when one is going back to something one previously was in, it's not the same. If you move house to a new area and move back to the old area, it's not the same. You've grown up, new people have moved in, the houses have changed. So it's not going to be, oh, we just keep it the same as it was prior to the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Everybody has changed. So I would say what really is there for employers, and they are asking for this advice, and indeed we're doing some work ourselves with other agencies to try and clarify this. Like, do speak to people, do consult, do listen, do ask what they benefited from being out of work or being, you know, at home doing the work. Really try to capitalise on that, because people do want to be heard when they're going back. They don't want to be just treated like they're just the same.
Yeah, so people go back into the workplace and something happens. You've got virtually nobody wearing masks unless they choose to.
Exactly.
And then lunchtime comes and someone decides to open up their sandwiches at the table beside you and start eating. Now that, if you're in any way anxious and you're back into the office after 2 years at home, that's going to cause some worry, isn't it?
Yeah, I know, Anne-Claire, like I know that. It's a bugbear of yours with the apple eating. I remembered last time.
Someone crunching an apple beside you. Yeah.
But the thing is,
COVID or not, that's annoying.
One of the big issues isn't really emotional as much as it is sensory going back to work. So these things about smells, eating, as you said, noises, you know, even being stuffy, can we open windows? Are the windows not openable? So a load of sensory things would be very important now. And also, don't forget, when people were working from their kitchen table or from wherever they were working at home, they could eat at the table. They could have the apple or the soup or whatever. And they got used to it, and they forgot nearly. So when they're going back now, it might be one of the things that they're, you know, lingering on to or hanging on to and trying to do. So I would say again to employers, just act like it's almost a mini induction back to the workplace, and very small messaging around, don't forget, guys, there's no eating at the desks, or if you choose, only eating at the desk between, you know, 1 and 1:45, and no hot food and no curries, mm-hmm, or something. So like, try to re-engineer things.
Because everyone's managing a little bit of anxiety. It's perfectly normal, you know, having not been close to people for all of this time in your workplace environment, you're then going back in there.
Yes.
It's a strange experience, isn't it?
All change is anxiety provoking. So people who actually suffer from severe anxieties and who are in clinical treatment, and we're not really talking about that here now, because obviously someone who's got severe anxiety, I would say go and see a professional, mm-hmm, GP, someone in the Psychological Society of Ireland or some accredited body. But people who have low level anxiety, which is very much, they can see themselves as to do with adaptation, as I mentioned the last time, like crossing boundaries. So going back to a position that we were once in, but it's different now and we have to go back to it. That's an anxiety for everybody. So you're not alone. You're not abnormal. It's completely fine. But what you need to really do is kind of think, is it that I have a very low tolerance for dealing with ambiguity and I've gotten used to being told what to do? In which case, that's something for you to do with yourself, but you can also talk to an employer. What is clear? What do I know? How can I reduce the ambiguity? Look at Monday, look at Friday. They're the boundary days. Is it really anxious for me on Sunday night because I have to go in on Monday? Could you go in maybe a little later? Could you go in a little earlier to avoid, maybe if you're trying to avoid being on packed public transport? So just try to adapt, make certain as much as you can for yourself in your own anxiety. And then when you're in the workplace, what often happens, Claire, is people who are ringing me are saying, I'm really worried about it. I say, well, look, ring me back on Friday. And by Friday, I think, actually, it's fine. It was fine by Tuesday. I just wasn't used to it. I imagined it to be worse than it was. Our imaginations are often our worst enemy and our best friend. Mm-hmm. Because we imagine something's going to be great. We actually rate it as better than, in fact, it was, because we imagined it was going to be good. So we don't want to let down our imagination, if you like. And if we imagine it's going to be terrible, we nearly experience it as terrible just to kind of keep up with our own imagination of what it was going to be. So we really need to kind of get in there and do it. And then reflect on what it was like. And then note down the things that you need change or you want change. If there's an EAP service maybe, or occupational health, or a manager or colleague. The social side of work really helps us to deal with the kind of individual, locked in our own head worries that we have. So use that too.
Yeah, and just going back to what you were saying about, you know, ventilation, windows being open, the eating at the desks and so on. I mean, putting rules in place to deal with those issues, it'll be very difficult to police that, very difficult for an employer to say no eating at the desk unless it's between 1 and 1/2 and keep that window open. Now, how do you make sure that that rule is adhered to? Can you?
Well, the thing is, there were always these like rules or edicts or protocols or ways we do things. It's just that's what feeds into the culture. Now, in some organisations, and I said they're all different, in some organisations, there's always been a rule around walking a certain way, using the stairs in a certain way, you know, for safety reasons, slips, trips, falls. So there always is in a workplace rules, and they have to be followed if they're safety or health and safety rules. And so what you do this time is you say, we're going to adapt some of the things that we'd like people to do. Now, if you can't police them, then you say, this is a guidance and we want people to follow them. You'll find normally in a workplace that's got a good culture, most people will kind of self-police. They won't want to be seen to be maybe the odd time they'll do the thing when no one's looking, like the window open or close it. But in general, you'll find everyone will want for other people to see that they're in with the way things should be done.
Yeah. In general terms, are you finding that people are exhausted going back to the office?
I was going to say emotional exhaustion is coming back as one of the things. And people don't really realise it. They're kind of maybe a little bit more snappy about things that aren't going their way, or a little bit more, let's say, intolerant about things. And I think it is often, it is an emotional exhaustion, and it's not really caused by work, actually. It may be, but often it's just the whole shebang, everything that went on and that's going on now. So there's a little bit of, in all of us, I think, emotional exhaustion. So it's a good thing summer is coming up, or it's springtime now, and that all matters to our mental health. You know, nature, being able to go out for walks, longer days, the thought of a holiday. So this all does make things better.
If you think about all the extra things you have to do when you've got to leave the house, decide what you've got to wear, you've got to organise your transport, think about your commute, do your commute, organise your food, get back home, factor in your exercise. Nobody's walked the dog because nobody's been at home all day. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, but we were doing that for a lot of years.
Yeah, but
it's just that we weren't counting it. Yeah, we weren't counting. So now it's kind of cognitively loading us up with things. But we did do it before, and there were so many benefits to it that we only realise when we do it. So the thing that we didn't predict in the day, bumping into somebody we didn't know, thinking a new thought because we saw something that triggered an emotion, all the evocative things that happen in a day that trigger our emotions and our senses that we don't know because they bypass our intellect. But it's kind of like suck it and see type of thing. Most people, when they get back to doing the thing, and obviously it has to be done in an organised, in a way that's suitable to people, but they will find that really there's enough things I like about it. And obviously there are other people who are saying, I've made my mind up. I'm not going back, or I'm moving job, or I'm changing career, or I'm, you know, taking more leave. So there are people who are making big decisions too.
Oh God, not big decisions. Can't someone else make them instead? That's Patricia Murray, work psychologist with the Health and Safety Authority, talking about post-COVID return to work on This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Everyone's saying post-COVID as if that will convince the virus that its time in the spotlight is over, aren't they? Worth a shot, I suppose. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio player. And there'll be another Playback Daily at the same time tomorrow. But from me, until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.